So I shall start by introducing myself then for those of you who don't know me. So my name is Anne van Kamp and I'm the curator of Northern European Art at the Ashmolean Museum, which I joined late September last year, so still quite recent. And before that I was the curator of Dutch and Flemish prints and drawings at the British Museum. So now Northern European art also encompasses the paintings and also the German school. So whenever I start a new research project or I go back to old research projects, for me, I always start from the objects that I'm responsible for in the museum. I will never sort of pick an idea out of the air and then try to find the objects for that. No, for me, it's really about the museum collections and what how they speak to me, what they tell to me. And one of my favorite topics has always been Netherlandish artists abroad. And as you can probably tell from my accent, I'm Belgian, I'm Flemish, and I'm abroad. So for me, it's a topic that is quite close to my heart, obviously. But I think it's also quite interesting when artists who don't stay in their home countries, artists who will venture outside, they will take with them their own culture, their own style. When they arrive in other countries, they will either assimilate the other culture or they will integrate it into their own art, and I think that mix, that result that comes out of it is very interesting. So for me it's quite interesting to work on artists who have worked abroad and then to try to find the different influences and assimilations in their art. In the light of this course, Antiquity After Antiquity, of course I'm going to talk about Netherlandish artists traveling to Italy, and I will discuss one artist in particular as a showcase whose name is Jan Breugel the Elder, which you can see here. And I know in this country it's sometimes pronounced Breugel, but I will try not to get carried away with that and pronounce it how I'm used to pronouncing it as Breugel. So apologies for my Dutch pronunciation in this. Before I will focus on Jan Breugel, and I will also show you more works on paper because that's the works of art that I'm more familiar with as opposed to his paintings. So I will discuss his drawings, also some related prints. Before I do that, I will give you a very quick overview of other Netherlandish artists who went to Italy, a brief history of how it came to be, who the artists were that would travel abroad, what their reasons were, what they were going to do in these countries, and what kind of products or works of art they would produce in these countries or when they return home. I will focus on the 16th century. Jan Breugel went to Italy in the 1590s, so that's the period I'll be focusing on today. And as I said, Netherlandish artist, and I'm sure you all know what Netherlandish means, but I'll quickly reiterate it. So Netherlandish artists are artists from the Low Countries. So when we're talking about modern countries, we're talking about Belgium, the Netherlands, but also the north of France, the western side of Germany, so that region. And just to make it easier today, we'll just call them Netherlandish, whether they're from the southern Netherlands, from Flanders, or from the northern Netherlands, from Holland. When these artists arrived in Italy, they were called also Fiamminghi, or Flamenco, or Belga, regardless of whether they were from the north or the south. In modern literature, strangely enough, they're not regarded that highly. So up until the early 20th century, even by really famous art historians like Max Roses, who published the catalogue Raisonné of Rubens in the late 19th century, Max Friedlander, who I'm sure you know, they considered these artists traveling abroad as, I don't know, sort of strange people, like arrogant for leaving their home countries, betrayers of their own culture. And I think that's quite unfair, because even though a lot of them did leave the Netherlands, most of them would only go for a very short time and return back to their home countries. And the few that have permanently settled in Italy, you can see that they really bring the Northern style, the Northern culture into Italian art. So I think that's a very unfair view. They call them the Romanists, the Italianists. And for me, as I said before, they're really the most interesting artists to work on. So when these artists are in Italy, As you can imagine, it's quite difficult to produce lots of oil paintings. So what they do to jot down their impressions, they make quick sketches, and for that they carry around lots of sketchbooks. And that's mainly what we have surviving today. When you go to museum collections around the world, what we find is drawings. And most of them are taken from these sketchbooks, which are now dismantled. So it's very rare to find a complete sketchbook nowadays. So most of the single sheets you will find in museum collections are taken from sketchbooks. And so that's what we'll be looking at today, sheets of these sketchbooks. So first I will give you a selection of the artists that went to Italy, and then afterwards I will go into more detail about Jan Breugel the Elder in particular. So as I said, I'll focus on the 16th century. This doesn't mean that artists never traveled to Italy before that. For example, we know that Roger van der Weyden or Rogier van der Weyden, he went to Italy, but it was a very different reason. So he went in 1450, which was of course one of the holy years in Rome. You know that every 25 years the Catholic Church announces a holy year, opens the churches up to pilgrims, and that always brings together lots of artists gathering in these cities. So Roger van der Weyden in 1450 already travels to Italy, not really to learn from the culture, because when he comes back to Flanders afterwards, you can't really see an influence in his art. But well, it's a visit, a sort of touristic visit that he does. Other artists will, for example, younger artists, because when Roger van der Weyden goes, he's already an established artist. Younger artists will go to Italy really to learn, to soak up the Italian art, not just of painters, of contemporary painters, also the old master painters that would be, of which paintings would be hanging in the palaces. But also, and especially I think in the 16th century, is for the Roman antiquities, because it's the period of all the excavations in Rome, and that really creates a buzz in Europe. So you have all these artists who want to go and study Roman antiquities, and we'll see a lot of the sketches that we'll look at today are of these Roman antiquities. Other artists go to Italy for religious reasons. For example, after the Iconoclasm, they want to go to a Catholic country, for example, and maybe hope to find work there. Some of them enter Italian workshops, start working for Italian colleagues, others set up their own workshop, others, maybe printmakers, will start working for print publishers in Rome. So there's lots of different reasons, lots of different kinds of artists who will go to Italy and spend their time differently in Italy. So if we then start with the 16th century, so one of the first Netherlandish artists to go to Italy, and again this is a bit like Roger van der Weyden, as a very short visit, is Jan Rossaert, and here you see a very beautiful study of the Spinario. And he goes to Italy in 1508, as part of a diplomatic mission, which is again one of the reasons why Netherlandish artists go to Italy. So he accompanies his patron, Philip of Burgundy, who was a bastard son, going for an audience with Pope Julius II. A later visitor to Italy, and maybe I shouldn't call him a visitor, because this artist, Jan van Skorrel, this Dutchman, he stays a lot longer in Italy. So he leaves in 1518, he goes to Venice, then travels to the Holy Land, visits Jerusalem, we've got views of Jerusalem by him, then comes back to Rome. When he comes back to Rome, the Dutch Pope, Adrian VI, is in charge, and he promptly offers him a job as curator of the Vatican, which is quite extraordinary if you think about it, to have a Dutch artist become a curator in the early 16th century. And so here we see, there's not many drawings that have survived by him, where you can clearly see this is a sheet from a sketchbook. There's even some, maybe a bill or a calculation in the top right corner. And then in the distance we see the Pyramid of Sestus, and then in the foreground some very loose, sketchy sketches that he made of some sculpture. Then, if we think of 1517, this was quite an important year for Netherlandish artists, and particularly tapestry designers, because that's the year when Raphael comes over to Brussels and to complete the cartoons that he was designing, the Acts of the Apostles cartoons, to be hung in the Sistine Chapel in the Vatican. And so that's a major year for tapestry design in Flanders, because he had to come to Brussels where the tapestries were being woven. And after the tapestries were finished, the big cartoons, the designs for these tapestries would remain with the weavers. And so they were available for Netherlandish artists, tapestry designers to see and study. And that creates a sort of mass, not, well, a big immigration of tapestry designers. So Bernard van Orly goes to Italy in the wake of seeing these cartoons, and with him his students, Peter Cooke van Aalst, Peter de Kempenaer, and you can see some fragments of cartoon by Peter de Kempenaer, who's also known as Pedro Campagna here. And actually the Ashmolean has a very good collection of, as you can see, cut out fragments of these tapestry cartoons, so it might be worth coming to see them in our study room. Also Michiel Coxey goes to Italy. So we can see that in the 1520s it's mainly tapestry designers coming from Brussels to Italy to study tapestry design. If we then move into the 1530s, we see a very different story. These are more artists. So as you know, Raphael dies in 1520, so now we're going to see artists who are more drawn towards Michelangelo, and one of the most famous artists of that decade going to Rome is Martin van Heemskerk. And when he arrived there, he was already quite an established artist, and he was much admired by his Italian colleagues for his landscape art. And as you can see, he makes these stunning studies of classical sculpture, but also what is quite interesting, most of the drawings we have are individual studies of a sculpture. What Martin van Heemskerk does is he gives us views of the palaces, so we actually get a view of how, and here we see the sculpture garden in the Vatican on the right, of how it actually looked in the 1530s. So we see the two great statues of the river gods in the foreground, and then in the background, in the niche, we see the Laocoon group. So I think that's quite interesting to get a sort of armchair tourism, like you get to see what is on offer by just looking at these drawings. In the 1540s, we see a different kind of artist going to Rome, and we see a lot more printmakers, print publishers, going to Italy, and one of them was the very successful Hieronymus Kock, who would, after he would return to Antwerp, again become one of the most prolific print publishers in Europe. So he goes to Rome in the 1540s, sketches a lot of ruins, then when he comes back in 1551, he publishes this a big series of these ruins, and they become hugely popular. They get republished over decades, other people will copy them in smaller formats. So there's clearly a hunger, an appetite to see these Roman views in Europe. Of course, one of the most famous people to visit Italy in the 1550s is Peter Bruegel the Elder, who is the father of Arjan Bruegel the Elder, who we will discuss later. And for Bruegel, it's different. Like, he doesn't necessarily go there to see the ruins. What he's really impressed about is the landscape. So when he crosses the Alps, it completely turns his life around, and they will appear in all of his later works. And here you see a stunning sheet in the Musée du Louvre of these Alps, that overwhelming nature that has clearly influenced Peter Bruegel. And then when he goes back to Antwerp, then we see that he collaborates with his friend Hieronymus Kock to publish another series. So first Kock publishes the ruins. When Bruegel comes back, he publishes a set of large landscapes based on Bruegel's impressions of Italy. And they were very popular as well, and reissued and copied, imitated. So another printmaker who would go to Rome, and this is one of my favorite printmakers, is Cornelis Cort. And he's not just a visitor. When he goes to Italy, he really goes there to stay. He wants to work in Italy. He wants to settle down you have to remember where it's around 1566, so the iconoclasm has happened, so lots of artists are moving south from the north. And so Cornelis Cort is one of them, and he's the most talented engraver of his time. And so he immediately finds works in publishers' works up by Salamanca, La Ferrie, and he works closely together with Titian. And here we see a stunning copy after one of Titian's paintings of Saint Jerome. The fact that he was so admired is also, you can see it's been hand-colored, the print afterwards, which was done sort of 10 years after the print was actually made, so in the 1570s. But the fact that someone invests so much money in the hand coloring and it's heightened with gold really means that this print was highly appreciated, that it was regarded as a top-end luxury product that deserved to be embellished like this. Then in the 1570s, more and more Netherlandish artists really go to Italy to stay, and they really try to find work there. And what happened is that it's the 1560s, 1570s, 1580s, so there's a lot of decoration projects going on in the Vatican palaces. And a lot of these artists eventually will find work making frescoes in some of the palaces. The northern artists are very renowned for their landscape skills, so what happens is they usually enter into a collaboration with their Italian counterparts, whereby the northern artists will draw the landscapes, and we're talking about people like Bartolomeo Spranger or Jan Speckart, as you can see here, while Italian artists like Antonio Tempesta will then provide the figures for these frescoes. And so, for example, they work for Pope Pius V, but also for cardinals like Alexander Farnese in his Villa Farnese in Caprarola. As you can see here, these artists really assimilate the Italian culture. Like this is, if I would see this drawing in a collection, I would not necessarily think this was done by a Netherlandish artist. This is really someone assimilating Italian culture in order to then get commissions and work for the popes in Rome. Two other artists who go over around the same time and follow the same patterns, also working in the papal palaces, are the two brothers, Matthias Brill and Paul Brill. And they were hugely talented, fabulous landscape artists. As you can see here, this tree is just magnificent. It's quite an influential tree. It's been copied by many Italian artists afterwards. When you go to Rome and go through the Vatican palaces, you can actually find this tree in many of the frescoes. So it's sort of a spot and find a tree when you admire these frescoes. So Matthias Brill, born in 1550, leaves to Rome when he's 25. So he arrives there in 1575. An instant success, gets commissioned to, for example, do the decorations of the Gregorian Tower or the Torre dei Venti in the Vatican. But then suddenly, in 1583, he dies unexpectedly, which is a great loss even for Italian art, I would say. Luckily, the year before, in 1582, he was joined by his younger brother, Paul Brill, in Rome, and he then takes over the workshop and the commissions, and luckily, as we will see later on, he also keeps all the sketches, all the sketchbooks by his brother, which he then generously allows other Netherlandish artists to come and study in their house and copy. So here we see some drawings by Paul Brill. Again, Paul Brill, in the wake of his brother Matthias, was very popular, highly collected. Masses of drawings are still preserved today in the Louvre, for instance, and you can see why they were very, very popular. Like, these are very attractive views. I think the lower left study, which is more in black chalk, is a study for the one in the top right, which is finished in ink, and you can really see it's a very atmospheric sheet. It's got that dark foreground, and then the dramatic landscape following afterwards. So you can see why he was very popular and collected. So I said lots of artists were then welcomed by Paul Brill in his house. One of these artists is the very famous Hendrik Holtius, who went to Rome in 1590, 1591. Of course, when Goltius goes to Rome, he's not a young beginning artist anymore. He is already the established Hendrik Goltius. He is the best engraver of his time. And you can see at these sheets that they're so accomplished. They're really capturing the statues. And all these sheets are taken from sketchbooks that Goltius took to Rome with him. This trip really changes his life, although he only stays for a short time. When he comes back home to Haarlem, to the Netherlands, you can see that he incorporates all these Michelangelo bodies into his prints, and I think Gervais has shown you some of his prints in some previous classes. But also in portraiture, like he gets really inspired by, for example, black and red chalk portraits which were done in Italy, and you can then see that he takes that back to Holland. I don't want to talk too much about 17th century, so I forgot to say, so at the same time when Goltius is there, we have to remember that Jan Breugel is in Italy as well, but we'll see more of his drawings later on. So just to quickly venture into the 17th century to sort of finish the story of Netherlandish artist in Italy. Of course, the first artist, and he goes there in 1600, is the great Peter Paul Rubens from Antwerp. So he goes there when he's 23, so still quite young, but the moment he arrives, he gets patronage from the Dukes of Mantua. His talent is instantly recognized, he's highly demanded as a portraitist. Then when he moves to Rome, he gets one of the most important commissions of the first decade of the 17th century, which is three paintings for the Santa Maria in Vallicelli Church in Rome, which were done on slate. And here on the left you see a preparatory drawing for it, and then the final product in situ on the right. So this was a great success, and Rubens stayed for 9 years in Italy, but then he has to go back to Flanders, and then we all know the story. When he goes back, his massive success continues there. And we know, looking at the figures in these paintings, that Rubens was clearly inspired by Italian art, but still remained his Flemish roots. One of his best pupils, Anthony van Dyck, also went to Italy, probably encouraged by Rubens. He went for 7 years, between 1620 and 1627. And surprisingly, he doesn't stay. He goes straight to Sicily, to the south, where there was also a big contingent of Flemish artists already working there. So spent some time there, then travels up north, and gets really inspired, not so much by Roman antiquities, but more by the Titian paintings, by the Raphael paintings. And there's a fabulous sketchbook at the British Museum in which he copies all the paintings, and he makes annotations saying, I've seen this painting in the palace of blah, blah, blah. And so you can really follow his trip to Italy. Then if we jump to the 1630s, 1640s, we see a very different kind of artist going to Italy. So these are, the previous artists we've seen are mostly Flemish. What we're now seeing in the 1630s and 40s are a lot of Dutch, so Northern, Netherlandish artists. And as you can see, they're not necessarily that interested in Roman antiquities or in the old Italian masters, but they're really, therefore, is for the light, for the Italian light, like that golden light. And all their paintings, even when they return back to Holland, you'll always see in Dutch paintings from the 1630s, 1640s, that golden light, even if you have done a flat meadow with some cows in it, in the background, you get that golden Italian light. And so they're called the Italianists. And so this is a very sort of special group of artists that will go there. They also, a separate group of artists, get very inspired by Caravaggio, and they're then called the Caravaggisti. And so you see a lot of clair-obscur in their paintings. So that's a very different strand of Netherlandish artists. So once these artists get there, how do they find each other? How do they organize themselves? And if we look at the early 16th century, we see that the institutions that they were based in are mainly linked to religious, probably charity societies linked to churches. And the prime reason for these institutions was, for example, to welcome pilgrims during the Holy Year, but also to arrange burials for Netherlandish people who would suddenly die in Italy, so a sort of repatriation or organizing of the burial in a foreign country. And then later on, when there's more and more artists and artisans, clerics even, moving into Rome, this function widens and they become a sort of social network. When the group of artists I just told you about, the Italianists, the ones that come for the golden light in Italy, when they arrived in Rome, things changed, because in 1577 the Accademia di San Luca has been founded, and so there's a lot of rules, a lot of guidelines, you need to pay a subscription, and some artists did actually participate in the Accademia, and for example Paul Brill had held many functions in the Accademia. This group of Dutch artists that arrived in the 1630s, 1640s, they're having none of that. And what they really want, and you see a really fun scene here in this drawing, like they just want to be free, and they call themselves the Bentvogels, which roughly translates as a flock of birds, so indicating they're free from the Accademia, they don't want to adhere to the rules, they don't want to pay subscription, and what they really do is just visit taverns and get drunk and then cause a lot of trouble in Rome, in the city centre. So you can imagine they were not much liked, but they were very proud of their activities. You can see they make all these drawings on the wall. There's graffiti scratched in some walls in the ruins in Rome, where you can trace their presence. So yeah, they were just really there to have fun. They also get nicknames, and so for example the artist who made this drawing, Peter van Laar, he was called the Bamboccio, which means ugly puppet, and apparently because his body proportions were a bit awkward, he had a short neck, a long upper body, and so they gave him the nickname ugly puppet. So it's that kind of society with very wild initiation rites. So this was the overview before then moving on to Jan Breugel. And here we have our man in a beautiful etching done by Anthony van Dyck. So I will first briefly say something about his life and then move on to the drawings. So Jan Breugel, born in 1568, which is sadly a year before Peter Breugel, his father, died, so he never really got to know his famous father. When his mother then later dies, 10 years later, he has to move in with his grandparents, so he has to move from Brussels to Antwerp. His grandparents, or his grandmother rather, is called Maaike Verhulst, and she's actually quite a famous painter in her life. Like, we don't know of any of her artworks, nothing has survived in museums, or at least nothing that we recognize as being by her hand. But she was the widow of Peter Cooke van Aalst, who we already mentioned as a great tapestry designer in the early 16th century. And so it must have been quite an exciting family to enter. And so when the young Jan Breugel moves in with his grandmother in Antwerp, she teaches him how to paint, and with a focus on miniature painting and watercolor, and that's something that we will find in his later works. So then, as a young artist, he's 20 years old, he's an orphan, he's got a lot of money because his father, Peter Breugel, was so successful. So the logical thing for him to do in the wake, in the footsteps of all these artists we've discussed earlier, is to go to Italy. So we know that he traveled to Italy over Cologne around 1588, and then he arrives in Naples in 1589. So it's interesting that not all artists directly go to Rome, but that they go to different places as well. So here we have two views, which were previously attributed to Jan Breugel the Elder of Naples. I'm not sure, I don't think they're very strong drawings, and in fact if you look on the verso of them, they hold inscriptions saying, for instance, Rome 1595, which would be really odd to have an inscription stating Rome 1595 when it's a view of Naples where Jan Breugel was in 1589. So I think these are probably not by Jan Breugel himself, but rather copies made afterwards by someone else. So by 1592, Jan Breugel does arrive in Rome, and here we got a very nice view of the Ripa Grande. And you see already some of the elements that Jan Breugel would become very famous for, the exact topography, but also creating depth by placing all these tiny minuscule figures in the foreground. We know that when Jan Breugel arrived in Rome, that he would stay with Paul Pril, because by that time Matthias Pril, of course, has already died in 1583. So, because he's a young artist, so he wants to have the support of some fellow countrymen, and he finds a very welcome open house with Paul Pril. When he's in Rome, he gets to know one of the Milanese cardinals, Federico Borromeo, and travels up to him to Milan. In 1594, stays at until 1595, and then travels back to Antwerp. So when he comes back to Antwerp, he really needs to live up to his reputation, because he is the son of Peter Breugel. So he starts a workshop, and he clearly inherited his father's talents and becomes very successful. We know him as the flower Breugel, we know him as the velvet Breugel, because he's extremely good in rendering textures in different realistic appearances. So when I think of Jan Breugel, I don't think of the Italian view drawings that I'm going to show you today. I think of these big still lifes, the flower pieces, or even more so the wide landscapes, the panoramic landscapes that just take you in with the hundreds of little figures in the foreground. So that's what he becomes really famous for, very prolific. And you can see why, how these kind of works would appeal to a wider audience. If you want to commission a painting to hang in your living room, you can see how this would be very attractive to have paintings like that. Because he was so talented in representing these realistic textures, he's often asked as a collaborator. So when he's back in Antwerp, he collaborates a lot with Rubens, for instance, whereby Rubens would provide the big figures in a painting, and then Jan Breugel would do the background landscape or the flowers, which are scattered in the foreground. And that's the typical Antwerp practice, where they're not competitors, they're not working against each other, they're all working together and sort of making the best products they can make in their city by combining forces. So then he dies quite young, 1625, he dies in Antwerp, and ironically he dies when his son, who is also called Jan Breugel, so Jan Breugel the younger then, when he is doing his trip in Italy, so this poor young artist has to rush back to Antwerp to then take over this hugely successful workshop of his father Jan Breugel, but that's another story. So we know that by Jan Breugel we have roughly 200 drawings that have survived, and most of these come from his Italian trip between 1589 and 1596. So I've already mentioned that he sought the company of Paul Pril, who held the drawings by Matthias Pril. So when Matthias Pril dies in 1583, all these sketchbooks are lying around in the house. Matthias Pril, as I said before, worked in the Vatican palaces on landscapes, and what he's really good at, as you can see here, is accurate architectural drawings. Like he applies this sort of art whereby you look at the buildings from a lower viewpoint and then create this fantastic perspective. And so there's lots of these architectural studies, almost mathematical studies, I would say, and these motifs you will then find replicated in the frescoes in the Vatican. He also does another sort of drawing, sort of like this, the Forum Romanum, which I find a lot more attractive, I say, than this. This is quite dry, it's quite measured. Well, this is a lot more lively. It really gives you an impression of how Rome looked like in the 1570s and the 1580s. Lots of other artists stayed with Paul Pril, And so we see that a lot of these drawings are eventually being copied and reused. And if you look at the foreground, it's quite empty, and I don't know how the Forum Romanum looked like in the 1560s and 70s, but the question is, was there just a field, or did Matthijs Bril then maybe leave a blank so printmakers could then add foreground figures? So if you compare, so this is the drawing by Matthijs Bril, one of the artists who stay with Paul Bril, Willem van Nieuwland the Younger. He, when he came back home to Holland, he would then turn these views into topographical prints, which is bizarre because it does it in reverse. So when you make a print, it will always be in reverse to the drawing. But it's a bit bizarre to do it for a topographical view because now everything is the other way around. These print series, as I've already mentioned before, for example, the Hieronymus Cock series of the Roman ruins, but also the Paul Bruegel, the Peter Bruegel landscapes, which Hieronymus Cock published, were extremely popular. And as I said before, they keep being republished. And here we have a view of the Forum of Nerva. And then when we look at the drawing by Matthijs Bril, which is kept in the Musée du Louvre, we see it's very similar. So all these stunning drawings, for example, like these by Matthijs Bril, which we think as original works of art, in fact then go back to earlier mid-16th century prints. And then there's of course the question, like, how many viewpoints can you get when you go to Rome? Like, what once the best viewpoint of a certain set of ruins has been established, it might be logical that all artists sort of go and stand on that position to make their drawing. But it's nevertheless very interesting, and I think it shows the Netherlandish artists sort of hark back to the past, keep repeating very popular motifs, and then reusing them in a creative way. So a lot of these drawings by Matthijs Bril have survived, as I said, partly because Paul Bril kept them, and he was clearly very proud of his brother's work. It's his older brother, so he really looked up to him. And so we have 15 to 20 sheets by Matthijs Bril, which are nowadays kept in the Louvre and in the Albertina. Here we have a view of the Forum Boarium with a goat hearth, which is ironic, for the Forum Boarium. And then here we have a very nice, I think, a signature by Matthijs Bril. So you've got a letter M in the lower left corner, and then a pair of glasses, because Bril in Dutch is glasses or spectacles, so I think that's quite nice. And this also proves that this is an autograph sheet by Matthijs Bril. Because if we look a bit further, we'll find two more versions of exactly the same drawing. So this is the Matthijs Bril sheet, and then there's two more drawings. And it's very difficult to find any differences, to really ascribe a specific hand. So we really have to sort of start looking at details. So luckily here we have the signature, so we can attribute it to Matthijs Bril. Here we have this inscription here, which says October 1594 in Rome. And we know that that is Jan Bruegel's signature from letters that have survived. So luckily we can attribute this. There's a third version in Chatsworth, in the Devonshire collection, which also has an inscription 1599, when we know Jan Bruegel is not in Rome anymore. But we have no idea who we need to attribute this drawing to, because the hand, the individual characteristics of the artist have disappeared. So it's very difficult, and a lot of research still needs to be done. If we compare the Matthijs Bril and the Jan Bruegel drawing, I can hardly see any differences. Even the hatching, the pen work is very similar. Sometimes you can find small differences here to differentiate it, but this is clearly an exact copy. This is clearly meant by Jan Bruegel to copy Matthijs Bril's drawing. A similar example here, the view of the Septizonium. This is the drawing by Bril in the Louvre. So then here again we have the version by Jan Bruegel in the British Museum with a very similar inscription as well, dated in 1594. And then here an anonymous version in Chatsworth, dated 1599. So, however, when we now compare the Brill and the Bruegel sheets, we can actually find a few differences. Especially in the lower right corner, in the Brill drawing, there is a draftsman making a sketch of the Septizonium, while in the Bruegel drawing, you see a group of shepherds resting against the wall. Also, when you look at the trees in the right background, you can see there are clear differences. And interestingly, if we go back to the Chatsworth drawing, we see that the Chatsworth drawing is actually copying the details that have been changed by Bruegel and not by Brill. So I think we now have to accept that the anonymous group of Chatsworth drawings are not directly copied from Matthias Brill drawings in Rome, as has been previously suggested, but rather after Jan Bruegel went back to Antwerp in 1599, a young artist entered his workshop and decided to practice his hand by copying his master's or Bruegel's drawings. Now this is a view of the Arch of Septimius Severus, and in fact we have 7 versions of this drawing, so it's not just a one-off, it's not just Jan Bruegel staying in Paul Brill's house and copying the drawings, it's a wider group of artists who are doing it. It's a common practice. When you go to Rome, you stay in Paul Brill's house and you copy Matthias Brill's drawings. And if you look carefully in the top right, you can see an inscription on the verso. And this is Paul Brill making an annotation on the back saying, "This is the best drawing I have by my brother Matthias." So he's clearly very proud of the drawings, wants to share them. So here is then the drawing we think can be attributed to Jan Bruegel in the Metropolitan Museum. There's a third one which has in the literature been attributed to Jan Bruegel as well in Chatsworth, but I think we need to place that with that anonymous group. It's a fourth version in the Courtauld Institute and a fifth version in the Rijksprintkabinet in Amsterdam. Then there's another one in Berlin, another one in a private collection. And so there's still a lot of research to be done. Who are these artists? Also, we know Matthias Brill was admired by his Italian colleagues, so some of these drawings have been attributed to Cantagallina, to Muziano, also to the Willem van Nieuwland, who made the prints after the drawings. So there's still a lot of research. So the question, I think, is why? Why are there so many drawings? Why, as a young artist, when you're in Italy, when you're in Rome, why don't you just go outside and enjoy the sunshine and make your own sketches? Why do you stay inside in someone's house and make meticulous copies? And I think there's different reasons. They are young artists, so they still need to build up their confidence, they still need to practice. Another reason might, for example, the Septizonian has been destroyed by the time Jan Bruegel arrives in Rome, so maybe he wants to have an image, a motif for a future work of a building that doesn't exist anymore. Maybe Paul Brill employed them to really start working in the style of his brother, and then create works of art in the style of his brother so he can continue, he can complete the many commissions he has. So there are many, many, many reasons. Here's another sheet. This is the tomb of Scipio, where we have the drawing by Matthias Brill and the Bruegel drawing, both in the Louvre, so you can compare them very well, and you see these clearly come from sketchbooks. They're very dirty sheets, they contain stains, all stains, they've been handled along the edges. What has happened here, and this could be one of the reasons why Bruegel makes so many drawings, is that he then later reuses it in his painting. So this is the Munich painting I've shown you earlier, and then in the left background we see the tomb of Scipio, which has been reused, and there's many more paintings of Bruegel in which this building then appears. And that's fun when you're researching Bruegel, you can sort of, it's like a jigsaw puzzle, he takes different elements and then brings them all together in one painting. And that is one of the reasons why he might have so meticulously copied these Matthias Brill drawings. This is another drawing attributed to Jan Bruegel, which is in the Fondation Custodia in Paris. And when I look at it, I see another one of these Matthias Brill drawings, but we have the inscription by Jan Bruegel. We don't have any version by Matthias Brill, but I think there must have been one originally which Bruegel copied, but which hasn't survived. But Bruegel damned us, and now we're sort of in the 1593, 1594, he becomes more confident, and this is another version of the Temple of the civil activity. And here you can really see Jan Breugel developing. So I told you that he's been trained in watercolor by his maternal grandmother. And this is very typical of Jan Breugel, to work with brown wash, but especially with the blue wash, which then creates all these different layers of depth. So I think here we see a more confident artist developing. Because if we then compare it with the Paul Brill drawings of the same subject, the Temple of Civil Activity, they're very different indeed. Like here we see the very typical Paul Brill drawing we discussed before, and this is very different from the much lighter, much more delicate drawing that Jan Breugel is so famous for. The same with this. So here we have the Castel Sant'Angelo. This is then the version that Jan Breugel makes of it. And it's almost like a breath of fresh air, I think, when you look at this. Like, this could still be very calculated. Well, this is a lot more spontaneous. You have the blue washes, you have the figures in the foreground. It's a real scene. And this is really what Breugel makes Breugel. And then so here we're in the 1593s, 1594s. This is a second group of drawings I briefly want to show you. These are all views of the Colosseum. And you see they're completely different from the copies he made after Matthias Brill. So we've got a really beautiful sheet at the Ashmolean. There's a similar one at the British Museum. And then this one in Berlin. So you see they're very spontaneous. He uses lots of wash. They're very, very pretty drawings, I think. And then the last group of drawings by Jan Breugel I wanted to talk to you about. Again, there's one sheet at the Ashmolean, which you should all, of course, come and see in the print room. And so if you look at these, they're sort of a combination of the drawings I've shown you earlier. So they're not the flamboyant, spontaneous Colosseum sketches like these. They're not the stiff, controlled drawings after Matthias Brill, but this is sort of something in between. We have the blue washes, we have the white panoramic landscapes going in the distance, we have the group of foreground figures, which are so typical of Brill. But I don't know, I feel like I'm missing something of that spontaneity that we find in his original drawings is lacking here. In fact, this is part of a group of four drawings. So we got one in Oxford, then, and so the Oxford, what I should say, is they're all views of the Western Bay of Naples. So they're mostly views of Pozzuoli and Baiae. So here we have the so-called tomb of Agrippina. Here we have the Temple of Venus or Diana at Baiae at the British Museum. Another sheet at the British Museum, Temple of Mercury or Echo. And then very recently, in 2005, this drawing was sold at Christie's and it entered an Antwerp private collection. So these are unidentified ruins at Pozzuoli. So these are all clearly from the same group. They all show they're done on the same kind of paper, done in the same technique. They represent buildings from the same region. So it's clearly a group. They also share a lot of the same provenance. So for example, the numbers you see in the lower right corner can be identified as belonging to Pierre Crozat. Then another stamp attributed to L'Empereur. So these drawings, this group of drawings, for some reasons entered in France in the 18th century. And then the drawing that has most recently surfaced on the market was then previously sold in 1975 in Amsterdam. So they've, again, like the Matthias Brill drawings, we saw the Jan Breugel drawings before. These drawings were probably kept in a sketchbook, kept together, and then they enter collections at some point during their collection history. So here are the four drawings together. And another point that they all share, which you can't see from the digital images, is that they're all indented. So it means that the artist has used a stylus, a blind stylus, or a sharp knife to trace along the contours of all the buildings, the rock formations, the figures, in order to transfer the composition onto another sheet. And the only reason why artists would have done that is if they needed to use this drawing in order to make another work of art. And in fact, all these prints have been turned into prints. So these are the drawings, these are the prints. As you know, normally prints are in reverse. These drawings are all in the same direction, which is an important aspect of topographical views, because you want to have them on the print as they appear in real life. So there must have been an intermediary drawing made by the printmaker in reverse, which is why our original drawings are indented. So these four prints all come from a series engraved by Egidius Sadler, and you see his name at the bottom in the caption. And they were published in a series called the Vestigi dell'Antichità di Roma, Tivoli, Pozzuolo e altri luoghi. So it's a set of ruins, of antique ruins, showing Rome, Tivoli, Pozzuoli and other places. As I said, done by Sadler, and then the first time published in 1606, as you can read the date below, in Prague. So it says Stampati in Praga. It's been published in Italy, this series. And you can also see a second name of Marco Sadler, which was a later publisher, so they would just add his name onto the copper plate. So this series, as you can already tell from the title page, would really appeal to humanists. It's an allegorical title page with personifications of fame, time on either side, and the title is written on a wolf skin, referring to Rome's history. And of course, we all know in Prague in 1606, we're dealing with the court of Rudolf II, who would surround himself with scholars and scientists and philosophers. So it's clearly meant for that audience. This is the frontispiece, and this indeed then refers, it's a dedication to Matteo Wackenau da Wackenfels, who's a Czech scholar at the court of Rudolf. He's very interested in science. He's in correspondence with, for example, Galileo Galilei and Kepler. And so from that inscription, it's clear that he must have commissioned Sadler when he was in Prague at the Rudolf court to make this series of antique ruins. And so we know that Jan Brueghel also went to Prague in 1604, which is 2 years before this print series was published, so we can reconstruct the commissioning of this plate. Surprisingly, Sadler then not really comes up with original views, but bases a lot of his views on an older publication from 1575, where you can see the title page of here, by Duperac, which only showed views of Rome, as you can see from the title, and you see it's a lot more old-fashioned than the flamboyant title page that Sadler creates. And so 38 of the 49 views are taken from that older 1575 series. So here we see the Castel Sant'Angelo, the Duperac version, and the Sadler version, which is almost identical apart from the addition of the sky in the background, which makes it a more lively view. So 38 plates from the Duperac series, and then the additional 12 plates, he had to come up with new compositions. So for example, one is copied, this is a view of Tivoli, one is copied after the famous Peter Brueghel print, which was published by Hieronymus Koch, as discussed before. And then the other plates representing Naples are the plates that we have discussed before, the plates that were done after Jan Brueghel's drawing. Surprisingly, Jan Brueghel is not acknowledged on any of these plates, but it's not very uncommon, because with topographical views, it's mainly about the view and not about the artist who drew it, because it was considered a view is a view and not really an artistic expression. So then, if we look at these drawings, so they're very different from the ones we've discussed before. They're not the spontaneous sketches that Brueghel made when he sketched the Colosseum. They're not the meticulous ones that he made after Matthäus Brühl, but these are intermediary. And I think what happened is when Jan Brueghel was in Prague in 1604, and there's a drawing at the British Museum which is signed Jan Brueghel in Prague, so we know exactly he was there, Matteo Swacker from Wackenfels must have commissioned Sadler to make a series of Roman ruins. Sadler must have asked Jan Brueghel, oh, you've been in Rome, you've made many of these sketches, could you maybe provide me with models? So that's when then Jan Brueghel made new drawings based on his earlier, more spontaneous sketches to fit the engraving style, and I think that's what we're seeing here. So I think in this talk I've tried to show you lots of different things, but mainly how these artists in Italy worked, their different working methods, and I hope I've shown you a sort of glimpse into how different drawings are made for different purposes by different kind of artists. Thank you.